For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Before we begin, we would like to thank Six Point Builders for their support of our show. Six Point Builders are builders of fine custom homes in the Boston metropolitan area.
Welcome to another episode of Revolution Recap, part of the Believe Podcast Network. We're coming to you after the New England Revolution won back-to-back league games for the first time since July 15th, 2023, defeating the Red Bulls 1-0 at home on the back of an 81st-minute goal by Ima Boateng. I'm Andy Judd. I'm hosting today, and I'm joined by Tom Pinzone of the Blazing Musket to talk about all this. Tom, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. You know, yesterday... You're saying that being a pretty nice day, you know, the weather worked out, everything was in the Revs' favor, and they got a result. So, yeah, all in all, pretty good.
Yeah, there certainly have been worse home game experiences, especially for Revs fans so far this season. So we'll take it. We'll take the good weather and we'll take a win. We have, a couple questions to get into this week, plenty to talk about. But first, before we do that, I do want to jump in and talk about our sponsor, BetOnline. BetOnline is your number one source for the NBA Finals and Stanley Cup Finals this season. Every stat, every matchup, and even live odds and spreads while the games are being played. When the game's over, head on over to our online casino and get in on a game of blackjack or poker, or unwind with one of our over 150 slots games. Head to the website today to get in on the action. Use promo code BELIEVE for your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet online, the game starts here. All right, now that that's out of the way, Tom, let's get into our key takeaways. Key takeaways are brought to you by our friends at the Rebellion Supporters Group. Be sure to check them out on Twitter at NERebellion and at their website, NERebellion.org. So why don't we start with you, Tom? What is your key takeaway from last night's match?
Look, I mean, it was just about good enough. I don't think you can really call it any more or any less than that. You know, it wasn't an inspiring performance that is had everybody, you know, jumping up and down and walking out of the stadium thinking, okay, like we're finally seeing, you know, the full potential of this team and you know, whatever Porter's system is. And like, it definitely was not that. It was a game where neither team created much of anything. I really feel for whoever had to put together the highlights package that I watched this morning, because it was underhit shots. A blocked cross made it into the highlight packet. I mean, it wasn't a great game. There wasn't a lot of quality chances. Neither goalkeeper was really challenged all that much. You know, Boateng's goal was probably the one moment of quality from either team in the whole game. And you know, like we talked about in the build up to this game, there's no Lewis Morgan, no Emil Forsberg, no John Tolkien, and they're missing their starting goalkeeper. So it's like this, you know. They got all the breaks that Porter's been talking about getting, and they got a 1-0 win at home. So it's good enough, and you know, we can feel good about it. But just because they got 3 points, and obviously those are desperately needed.
Yeah, I think those are all good points. I would agree. I watched this game in person last night. I think you did as well, Tom. It wasn't exactly, you know. It wasn't exactly the most exhilarating game of soccer to watch. You know, just looking through the stats here, the Revs had 0.75 expected goals. This is per FOTMOP, so I think this is OptiStats here. 0.75 expected goals. The Red Bulls had 0.91. There were 13 shots for the Revs, 15 for the Red Bulls. And one big chance was created in the entire game, and that was the Revs. So, you know, not exactly the most exhilarating game of soccer. I would agree that I don't think that this is indicative of, you know, any sort of coming to fruition of, you know, Caleb Porter's system or anything like that. You know, I think they probably played a little bit closer to what he was looking to accomplish. And I, you know, there were a couple of good moments, a couple of good, you know, passages of play, build up sequences where they were moving the ball pretty quickly. And I know, you know, we'll probably talk about that at some point. But, you know, nothing too drastic. I would love to feel, you know, happier about a 1-0 win. And in this season where we have just the 4 wins now, I think, you know, we have to be able to be happy about this one. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a dominating performance by any stretch of the imagination.
No. And if you look at the shot charts for both teams, you can see that, God, can't talk this morning. You know, the Revs had very few shots, you know, across the width of the 6-yard box inside the penalty area, right? They really only had 2 shots that you could say were in that zone, which is obviously where you want to shoot from as often as possible. And then the Red Bull shot chart is Red Bull shot chart is extremely poor. I mean, they were shooting from well outside the penalty area. So you know, there was some good movement of the ball from the Revs. They got a 4 quickly, you know, here and there. You know, they did get caught offsides. I think it was 3 times in the first 13 minutes, trying to go long to Veroni, who, you know, showed that whatever they came up with this week to try and get him involved, you know, that didn't really work either. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's progress, because it's kind of the same type of win that every win has been this season, right? They won by a single goal. And, you know, maybe a bit fortunate to hold on at the end.
Yep. I think that's all fair. Yeah. The shot charts are pretty funny to look at, because there's, you know, it's just almost all exclusively outside the penalty area for both teams. So I did a preview of the Red Bulls game the last time around. I was cautiously optimistic that the Revs could probably still lose, but maybe lose less badly than they had been. And a lot of that was based upon the fact that the Red Bulls actually don't create a ton for themselves. Now, I of course, forgot to factor in that the Revs are more than happy to let other teams create chances and big chances against them. So that was my mistake. Not a ton of in-the-box, chance creation from them last night. And, of course, that comes with the caveat that they were missing a bunch of players. So, you know, we won't read too deeply into it. But, this game played out a little bit closer to what I thought the last meeting would play out like, and it all we had to do was play them at home when they were at about 50% strength. That was the trick. In terms of my key takeaway, I'm gonna highlight I think you kind of touched on this briefly, Tom, when you were talking about balls into Frioni. I've seen kind of mixed reactions in reading through comments online about his game. I think I fall pretty squarely on the side of he did not particularly have a great game last night. The Revs seem to be playing long fairly often. I think the idea there, of course, is to try and bypass the press that the Red Bulls are known for, and try and move transition moments if they are to happen. If you're going to lose possession, try and move the ball further upfield before they happen. So, you know, we saw a lot of long goal kicks from Ivicic last night. We saw a lot of balls over the top, and in particular they were trying to target Vrioni, because he's the guy that's up there, and that's theoretically one of his jobs. So I have seen comments on Twitter that said that he did a good job with hold up play last night, which was a little funny for me to read, because I think I was sitting at the game, and I think I told my wife probably towards the end of the game, I was like, I don't think he has won a single header yet. That was not technically true. I did go through his stats. He won 2 of 8 aerial duels. He did win 2. I don't remember them. I feel like I would have, because I was paying particularly close attention to it. But in any case, from a strategic standpoint, I can understand the Revs wanting to boot long and then try to build through Vrioni as a hold up player, try and bypass that press. But I don't think it was particularly successful. I that just to me has not really been a strong suit of Vrioni's game. Is winning the ball in the air in particular, but then even holding up, you know, I feel like even when he got the ball on the ground, he was, you know, he had a hard time connecting with his teammates after that. And, he spent a lot of the time, it seemed like, kind of getting pushed around by the center backs for New York, and spent a lot of time kind of on the ground. So I didn't think he had a particularly good game. I wrote an article, my first article, by the way, for the Blazing Musket, which was about whether or not the Revs were doing enough to feature him. That was based upon comments from Caleb Porter that he had made a couple weeks ago, actually after the last Red Bulls game, because Frioni scored in that one. So he had made some comments to the effect that that the Revs need to do a better job of finding Frioni when he's in those good spots. I feel like they tried to play into him and through him a lot yesterday, and I don't think that was particularly successful.
No, I mean, the key thing about hold-up play is you have to hold up the ball. Like, I don't recall one time, you know, it's funny. If you watch the warm-up that they do before the game, they run through this little pattern where they knock it up to Vrioni and he knocks it back to Hill, and then Hill like takes a shot or plays in one of the wide plays. It's like this quick little up back through, right? It's like, you know, 2-3 yard passes. And that seems to be the only time that Vrioni is capable of receiving a pass and knocking it back is in the warm-up to the game when Kailas is standing 3 yards behind him. He's brilliant playing, you know, up back throughs and knocking it back and spinning out, making a run in practice before the game when the other team isn't trying to stop him from doing it. So maybe that is where people are seeing this hold up play. And if you are going to be a hold up striker, that means the team is getting the ball up to you. You're getting on the ball and you're bringing other players into the attack. And once again, last night, he had 9 attempted passes. He played the entire game and he attempted 9 pass. That is not the play of a hold up striker. 9 attempted passes a game. I mean, it's just like, come on, you know. And there was one time where they slipped on the ball in the only way in which he wants to receive it is he was running in behind at the top of the penalty area and was, you know, one or two touches away from getting a shot off. And he actually cut the ball back and played a back pass. In the one instance where they got him the ball in the only way that he can be effective, and he literally turned away from the opportunity and played the ball back. I mean, I just, someone's like, oh, you got to go back and watch the tape, man. Like, no, I don't want to see Vrioni in any capacity until I have to next Saturday.
Yeah, I think I know the moment you're talking about. He seems like he's battling. He's not in on goal necessarily, but he doesn't have very much work left to do. He might have a defender on that he could probably beat with one or two touches. And he pulls it back and he looks for a pass. And I think he overhits that pass. I forget exactly who it was targeting, but he overhits probably that pass and the chance kind of dies there. And I remember my wife turned to me and she said, Vrioni might be the only striker in the league that looks to cut back and play possession from that spot on the field. Cause he was, maybe 8-10 yards from goal at that point.
It's remarkable.
So yeah, not a great game from him in my opinion. Just a quick note: he had 25 touches, so that is technically above his season long average. His season long average, I think, is around 21. Maybe steps in the right direction, I guess. But did he have the fewest touches? I don't know. I assume so. So as part of the article I wrote for the Blazing Musket this past week, I went over, how many touches he has per 90 as compared to strikers within the league or forwards within the league per FBRef's, classification. Of players who have played at least 4 full games, 360 minutes, he has the fewest touches of any forward in the league per 90. He has the second fewest pass receptions of any forward per 90, and he has the third fewest progressive pass receptions of any player So, you know, I think league average in terms of touches per 90 is 36 or 37. So that's average. And he had 25 in this game. And we're saying that's, you know, that's above his usual. So, you know, a pretty tough go of it there. All right. Yeah.
He had more touches than Boateng and Farrell. So
that sounds about right.
Farrell played 10 seconds.
That's correct. All right, Tom, I'm going to set you up. We have some questions to get to today. Kind of a lighter night in terms of questions, but let's get into our listener mailbag, which is brought to you today by Subchuck Law. You can find Subchuck Law's website in our show notes. Are you ready, Tom?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to set you up with a question. This one's from Steve McGrogan on Twitter. This is about Marc-Anthony Kay. So Marc-Anthony had great moments, just to follow him up in the same breath with a head shaker. Could say the same for half the team. Runs not being made or old automations acting like ghosts haunting the new system. So why don't we, why don't we take this opportunity to talk about Marc-Anthony Kay's game? You have any thoughts?
He had great moments. In the game last night, he had great. I thought Kay was. It's probably one of the worst performances he's ever had. He should have been subbed off at halftime. I mean, he was completely off the pace. Wasn't really connecting with the pass. Wasn't able to connect passes. Didn't seem ready for the ball. You know, he was caught out defense. I mean, he was. How he got a 8.1 match rating from FootMob, I have no idea. I think FootMob seriously overrates like knocking passes 10 yards to the person next to you. He was very poor. And if Porter was a more proactive coach, which he clearly isn't, he's a very reactive coach. And you see that with the substitutions that he makes in the second half of the game. He just kind of sits on his hands and doesn't do too much. Kay really should have been off at halftime. Harks had played well, in that wide-ish position. And I thought he did, I thought he did quite well out there. But at the same time, I thought Kay was really, really poor, and it would have been justified to take him off at halftime and slide Harks into the middle and bring, maybe bring Ima on at halftime or maybe bring Panayiotou on, who obviously, as we now know, was recalled from Rhode Island for absolutely no reason. So, no, I didn't think Kay's performance was at all good last night. And Polster picked up his sixth yellow card of the season. And he had one of his yellow cards deducted from his record because he actually managed to go five games without a yellow card, which is remarkable for him in particular. But he picked up yellow last night, so he'll be out next week. So you got Polster out next week. Kay had probably his worst performance of the year, but he's probably going to have to start again because Polster's not available. So, I guess he gets another chance next week to put in a better performance, but there was nothing from last night that would make me think that Kay should be out there next week.
Yeah, I'm just as baffled as you are about the FootMob rating. I peeked into his stats. He did have kind of the sort of stats that FootMob tends to like with regard to how they set up their ratings. I think he won a bunch of duels or something like that, according to the statistics. But I don't remember at any point thinking that, he was doing anything above and beyond what would have been, expected of a player in his position, really any player in his position. And he did have a couple of really tough moments, in the game where I think he slipped and fell one time. I don't know if I necessarily blame him for that versus, the pitch or whatever happened there. But, he also has a really bad pass that ends up, with the New York Red Bulls player there for a bit. It's just like a completely, underhit pass, and it ends up changing possession in a really tough spot of the field. So I don't think anything that he did really impressed me, and he had several moments that were, pretty, pretty tough to watch. So I wasn't particularly impressed with him. You also brought up Jack P, and I know we had a question in here about Jack P, if I can find it. I believe it was from Jay Catanese on Twitter, who was asking, what's the point of recalling Jack P if you're not going to use him? And I think that's a fair question. I think there was a time in this game where you could have pretty easily, made the sub, especially, for Barrero, who I thought looked a little bit off again, a little bit frustrated last night.
yeah, Borrero, you know, his end product has not come back yet. You know, he looks good. You know, on, he looks good on the ball. His speed seems to be back, but his, you know, when he gets into that moment of, you know, trying to put in a cross or trying to pick out a teammate or take a shot, you know, he had a shot last night where, okay, he cut in, you know, I mean, under hit and it rolled to the goalkeeper. I mean, good shot or good spot to shoot from, but not a great shot. He had that shot, pass, whatever thing that hit the side netting and was nowhere near going in the goal. So yeah, his end product really doesn't seem to be back yet, which is, I mean, it's understandable. He was out for a long time. It's probably gonna, I think you just kind of have to hope it comes back at some point. But as far as Paniuto, I mean, there's no point for him to be recalled if he's not going to play. And Porter said during the week, you know, yeah, he might start or he might just be an option off the bench. And then you don't even use him because the plan ended up being to play Harkes, you know, somewhat out of position, which meant that you have Boateng on the bench as cover for the wide players. You had Peyton Miller and Farrell as cover for the outside backs. You had Mensah and Kessler cover at center back. You had Bobby Wood available. Like, you had cover all over the field. And Paniuto, you know, he probably would have played the full 90 last night in Rhode Island. And, you know, good for him. Rhode Island certainly could have used him. They, you know, they dropped 3 points last night. So all in all, it doesn't really make a lot of sense why he was there last night.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, recalling a player, you know, I can understand from a roster construction standpoint just to have bodies. But, you know, if you're not going to use him, you know, you'd have to think that he's probably better served by getting minutes with Rhode Island, where he was actually playing and getting, you know, good experience and seemed like he was doing pretty well for himself down there. So I don't know that I necessarily think it was a smart choice. You know, at the end of the game, you know, we have a goal lead. So I situationally can more so understand it, but we had four center backs out there. You know, we had the two that we started with and we subbed on both Andrew Farrell and we had subbed on, I'm forgetting his name now, Jonathan Mensah. So, you know, between the four of them, you know, I can understand you're really trying to lock down this one goal lead against a team that's generated under one expected goal. But still you'd think there'd be an opportunity to put him in with the lineup that you had as depleted as it was. And if you're not going to use him, then, you know, what are you doing here? Right. You know, I think you should be trying to think about the player at least a little bit. And so if you're not going to use him, he's probably better served in Rhode Island.
What we don't know is if he's going to be able to go back to Rhode Island. No one really seems to know you know, what the protocol is if you can, you know, if you can do like a repo and take the guy back for 1 week and then send him back on the loan that he was on, or potentially if he's going to have to wait until the transfer window opens in July, that means he's going to spend the month of June, you know, not playing much like he was, you know, back in March. So it's really, yeah, if you just need players on the bench for the night that aren't going to play and you just need them to be there for an emergency, then just bring up a couple of the Revs 2 players. You can bring them up temporarily. Just do that to fill the bench out. But the, you know, just the larger point though on Porter, you know, we know that he's only playing Esmir because he's been forced to. The moment that he had Borrero and Chonkalai available at the same time, you know, I mean, it only lasted 12 minutes, so it's easy to you know, forget that. But as soon as he had Borrero and Chonkalai both available, they both started and Esmir was on the bench. Nacho was starting over Esmir before he got injured. So the only reason that Esmir is playing is because Caleb's been forced to play him. Buck hasn't been playing at all because he hasn't been forced into playing him. And, you know, Jack obviously got no opportunities and now he's gone out on loan. So the young players are not getting opportunities from Porter because he's giving them to them. He's being forced to play Esmir. So there was no reason to expect that Paniuto was going to even get on the field last night.
Yep. Yeah. You know, Porter has a history of, you know, I know he came into the league with a reputation for playing younger players, but, you know, he was a college coach. So I don't really know that counts for a whole lot there. But in the interceding years, he's really kind of shied away from playing youth. You know, Esmir has some stars, but like you said, that's really kind of mostly been because there haven't been a ton of other options, or at least he has been starting when there haven't been other options to start ahead of him. So, you know, I would love for Jack Penio to be able to grow into a role here with the Revolution, but I'm just not sure I see it happening under Caleb Porter in the current setup. All right, let's move along here. I have a question here about Barrero. So this is from Thor Von Brandon on Twitter. It says, what role does Barrero play on this team? Does not seem to be a Buchanan speed striker. Unclear now that he is back how he fits in. So do you have any thoughts on Barrero's game and where he might fit within the team and how we could best utilize him?
Well, first of all, no one on this team is capable of being a Tajon Buchanan level player. You could be a Tajon Buchanan type player. And I think Barrero could be that player. Yeah, but again, you know, Porter has this system where he likes to have the pocket guy or the pocket guy and the stretch guy or whatever. I felt a lot of times last night Barrero was actually coming in too narrow too early in the attack. And you know, he does have tons of speed and he is a good dribbler. And that's the type of player that you typically would want to see staying out wide, get on the ball, draw the outside back to him, and then, you know, engage him, take him on 1v1 and get past him. We don't see a lot of that from anyone on this team, and certainly not from Barrero. So I think it's just more Barrero's not being unable to play that role because Porter doesn't want him to, which is really frustrating because I think that's where he was at his best last year, was as that wide dribbling player that would take someone on and beat them. And then all of a sudden he opens up a ton of time and space for himself to make good decisions. You know, we haven't really seen that yet. I wouldn't put all of it on Barrero. I just think it's part of the system. You know, I mean, Buchanan was a special talent athletically and in terms of his technique. You know, I mean, he was in that 4-4-2 diamond. He was essentially playing two positions at the same time. But yeah, I just think it's the way that Porter is using Barrero really kind of limits the type of, he's trying to turn him into a kind of a, like a center attacking mid, which I mean, okay, that's fine. Like, you're not saying that's not a role that he can do. He played some good passes there, but you already have a guy that can do that. So I don't really understand it, to be honest.
Sure. Yeah. And I think kind of the premise of the question is a little bit, I don't want to say flawed, but I think a lot of people will conflate Dylan Barrero with Tajon Buchanan because, you know, the Revolution sold Tajon Buchanan and then like the de facto replacement positionally was Barrero. So, you know, I don't think that there's necessarily, or there necessarily has to be any sort of, you know, similar qualities between players. I do think that Barrero has enough speed on him when he's, you know, fully fit that he can be useful in that way. But I don't think that there's necessarily any sort of, you know, there's no reason that he has to play exactly the way that Tajon did. So I don't necessarily expect him to fill the exact same role. And you know, I thought his game last night was a little bit shaky at times. You know, I saw he was close to our section, Tom. I think we're in the same section at the games. But when he kicked the ball out of bounds, I think it was just a bad touch. And, you know, he's very clearly visibly frustrated. So, you know, I think there's probably some element of it where he's coming back to full fitness. He's not quite, you know, up to full speed. And, you know, it's tough to come back from a year-long injury like that. But yeah, I don't know. I think he's got some work to do to come back to what he was last season, but I wouldn't expect that to be what Tajon was at his peak.
Yeah, no, I mean it's not fair to expect that. You know, you're probably not going to see that again for a while.
Right. Okay. All right. Let's see. I have a question here. I like this one from Steve McGrogan again on Twitter. He says, "At least they score bangers. When will the goal come from something besides a next to zero expected goals?" So that has been a theme of the Revs so far this year, which has been that they don't create a ton of clear cut chances and they have kind of relied on Carlos Heel to take one from the edge of the box or lower percentage shots. Right, last week we had that 2-1 win. I think both were low expected goal shots. I don't know what, off the top of my head, what the XG on Boateng's shot was, but the Revs' entire expected goals for the game was 0.7, so it wasn't very high. When are we going to see, are we going to see any sort of change, where we create more clear cut chances, or are we going to be stuck relying on kind of these moments of brilliance?
Well, the thing is, they never seem to get the ball into the penalty area, in spots where somebody can, just tap it in or put their foot through it, from around the 6-yard box, around the penalty. Like those types of balls don't come into the penalty area. They just don't happen. And again, I think a part of that is the wide players are, particularly Barrero and Chonkalai, are moving centrally too early and they're cramping things up. They're allowing the other team's defensive players to filter back in and defend the penalty area. Whereas if you stay wider longer, you stretch that back line and you start to open up gaps. And, then maybe you beat someone, you get to the goal line, and you play a cutback, you kind of square it back on the ground towards the penalty spot, and there's runners. They also don't really have runners in the penalty area. It's pretty much Veroni, and then everyone else is just kind of like positionally standing around the penalty area. Last year or in Polster's time here, you occasionally see him, make that like late run into the penalty area and just, smash his foot through the ball. And you need a couple of those type of goals a season. You need a couple, guy just barrels in there, ball comes to him, doesn't have time to think, he puts his foot through it, and sometimes those go in or they ricochet and you get a corner or you get a handball, you get something, but they just don't create those types of chances. And then obviously the person that they're aiming for, Veroni doesn't, I don't know how simple of a chance he needs to score. But that's also the biggest issue is even when they do get the ball into the area where simple goals can be scored from, the primary person in there is Veroni, who doesn't seem capable of doing even the simplest of things. That's why we're, that's kind of where we're at with only getting, these ridiculous goals. Two last week, the XG on last night's goal was 0.14. The winner that Chonkalai scored, I can't remember who it was against. That was like a 1 in 100 chance goal, and it's okay for now, but it's this can't be the chance creation system that we're going to play with.
Right. Yeah. So I worry a little bit about. I think we got a question about this somewhere. I'll have to track it down. But about how this reflects on Caleb Porter, right? Because we have a couple of wins now. Last week against Nashville, this week against the Red Bulls. And in both cases, I don't think I saw anything that looked sustainable in terms of creation of chances, right? All the goals were, kind of lower chance shots. And it's fine if you're creating, a lot of lower chance shots, right? Because eventually stats say, one of those will go in. But, relying on relatively few number of relatively low percentage shots, right, is not going to be a sustainable method. I'm certainly happy for the two wins, but nothing about their overall chance creation makes me feel confident that that's a sustainable method for winning games. And I think that we kind of saw that earlier in the season. We have 10 losses already, so I don't think that that's a surprise to people, but certainly happy that things broke the right way in this game. And I think to your point earlier, like a lot of there were moments in the first half, especially, I think probably 30th to 45th minute, there was a stretch there where it looked like the Revs were, playing what I think the ideal of Caleb Porter's system is, which is, it's a lot of possession, but it is, it's quicker passing. It's more quick motions. And then we had a couple of opportunities where Carlos Heel, who I thought actually had a very good game last night, he's able to pick out that pass in behind that other people aren't, expecting. It's just that we don't have the speed and we don't have like the finishing power up top to make anything of those moments. So, maybe there's some opportunity to work towards playing that, you know, that way that we played for like a 5-10 minute stretch for the full 90. But even then, you need someone who's going to be able to put the ball in the back of the net.
Yeah, it's the same. It's the same story it's been for the last three seasons. Is for all this stuff that is supposed to have changed and been different, the team is overly reliant on Carlos Hill to essentially do everything. I mean, it's the same story it's been since 2022.
Right.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, so I have a question here from AMC on Twitter. With Polster out and K in bad form and possibly hurt, I can't stop thinking about Arriaga and Harkes playing in front of Romney and Kessler. No idea if he's played a DM, but I feel like Arriaga could be decent there. Would that ever happen and could it work? So any thoughts on using Arriaga a little further up the field in like a defensive midfield role?
Like theoretically, sure. Caleb Porter, no. he likes him at center back. He's stated that it's really a matter of Arriaga is locked in as a starter, and it's just a matter of who's going to play next to him.
Right.
So given Porter's track record and how much he talks about continuity and whatever, I don't think there's any point in having the theoretical discussion, because I don't think it's I don't think that'll be on his list of options. There are several players in this team that have been able to play poorly multiple weeks in a row, and it seems to have no effect on their playing time. And it seems like Kay will be in that situation next week. Polster can't play. Kay almost certainly is going to have to. So I think we might see Kay and Harkes, you know, if they were willing to think a little bit outside of the box, maybe they would try, you know, Kay and Buck, but you know, again, he hasn't given Buck much of an opportunity, so I highly doubt it. I think we're just going to see Kay and Harkes for a week. And the second Polster is back and available, he'll be back in and Harkes will be out.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, could he play there? I mean, maybe. I don't know if he has played there in the past,
he could.
I mean, sure. Yeah. Right. Yeah, absolutely. In theory, right, his skill set would be fine in that spot. I just don't see it happening as a matter of practice.
Yep.
All right. A question here from Porter on Twitter. Please explain how the Shankalai as striker experiment went and why playing Shankalai as a 9 is worse than having Shankalai Barrero on the wings. We had a couple opportunities to see Shankalai play as the striker this season, mostly because Frioni was absent, right? I think he played or he missed a game with a red card pretty early in the season. So we got to see this fairly early on. I don't think he looked great there in his time as striker, but also I also don't think that Frioni has generally looked great. So, you know, at a certain point, we're kind of trying to think of what's the better option here. Do I think that's his ideal position, Shankalai up top? I personally don't. But I don't know who else you play up top, because I don't see Vrioni getting it done at the moment. So I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on what we would do, with Shankalai up top, or if that's a better option?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I don't really follow. I don't know if Porter, if he's being disingenuous or not with this question. But first of all, Shankalai is currently injured, so it's another theoretical. You know, when he comes back, if Frioni is still being as ineffective as he has been, and it's not July and they haven't gotten another striker, you know, it's a theoretical conversation for when Shankalai is available. But at this point, look, Shankalai knows how to score. Frioni does not appear to know how to score on anything close to a consistent basis. So I would be willing to try almost anyone on the team up top instead of Frioni at this point. And, you know, now that the team is shifting, and of course, you know, Porter will never own it. We'll get into how to deal with Porter later. They're going back to being a counterattacking team, you know, a team that plays quickly and bypasses the midfield. Chonkolai can run in behind. He can, you know, he can shoot. He can make things happen. He can create on his own. You know, he would actually be a pretty good player in a quick attacking team that bypasses the midfield and, you know, and launches out from the back more often than they don't. And they were trying to be that the mythical positional team that Porter was talking about earlier in the season when Chonkolai did get his opportunities up top. So I don't see any reason why. Let me this way. If Chonkolai and Borrero and Esmir and Carles are all available at the same time, there is no reason why the four of them should not be on the field together. None. And while we've got to get Veroni in there, that cannot possibly be the reason that you have to sit one of those four down. I mean, it's total nonsense. All four of them are far, far superior attacking players than Veroni. So the second all four of them are available, they should all be in. And if Veroni's the odd man out, no one besides Veroni is going to care.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And worth noting that the last I've heard is that there's no definite specific timeline on Chonkolai's return to the lineup,
which is bad.
Which is not a great sign if you don't have if you don't have a timetable.
Well, they said the swelling. They said that the swelling hasn't gone down enough yet to get like a definitive MRI, and it's been 2 weeks. From my understanding of knee injuries, if you can't even do a scan for 2 weeks because the swelling is too much, that's probably because the swelling is covering up a very, very bad injury. So I don't think we're going to be seeing much of Chonkolai for the rest of the season.
Right. Yeah. You know, we'll hope for the best on that one. Actually, there is a question from Derek Terrell here on Twitter that says, how much longer until we get by and Chonkolai back? So it seems like we're not too optimistic on how soon we could get Chonkolai back. I think there's more optimism on when we could get by back. I know he's been back in practice, you know, doing some drills. From what I've heard, it seems like he's on track to come back in, you know, a couple weeks, a month, somewhere in that kind of range. I don't know if you've heard anything more updated than that, Tom.
Yeah, I think Porter for like the last 3 weeks has said that he's 3 or 4 weeks away. So,
right.
You know. Good old Porter reliably can't get pinned down on anything. But my guess would be we'll see him in July, but I don't think we'll see him start a game until Leagues Cup. That would be my guess.
Yep, I think that probably makes sense. Okay, moving on. We have a question from Randy LH on Twitter that says, to my eyes, Kay looked even worse than usual. Will that combine with Hark's good performance result in a lineup change in the midfield? I think you touched on this pretty early, that you thought that Hark should be stepping in for Marc-Anthony Kay. Do you think that's the best way moving forward? And do you think that Porter will do that when all the players are available?
No, I don't think Porter will do it. Porter, the changes that Porter has made to the team that have improved the team's performance, he's been forced into almost every single one of those. Again, if it was up to him, and he says this every week, you know, he wants continuity. He wanted continuity in a team that was losing, which is interesting. but if you think about the moves that he's been had to make, again, you know, Esmir coming back into the team, he was forced to do that. You know, he dropped him, and it only lasted for 12 minutes because Chonkolai got injured. But, you know, we have to remember that. Esmir got back into this team because Chonkolai and Nacho are both injured, not because Porter, you know, Porter comes out and says, oh, I love this kid. Do you? Because you certainly haven't shown him that much love when you've actually had other players to pick from. Romney, I mean, we all know the Romney story. He benched him, said he wasn't good enough, tried to trade him, and now he's turned around and like, oh, no, Dave, you know, Dave, he's an experienced veteran player. He played every minute of every game last year. You know, Dave, he's just a great guy to have around. I mean, like, he was forced into that. And, it has to be noted that Romney's been back into the team for two games, and it's the first time all season that they've picked up points in two consecutive games. And I really don't think that that's a coincidence. So most of this stuff, he gets forced into it. So if Polster's suspended next week and Harks comes out and has a great game, okay, great. But we know how he feels about Polster, and he's going to get him right back in there.
Yep. Yeah, I will be surprised if we don't see, kind of the same thing we have been seeing. I think, yeah, to your point, we've heard Porter talk about wanting to have continuity in his lineups. And, for him, continuity seems to be Mark Anthony Kay and Matt Polster in that midfield, too. So we will probably see much more of that if everyone's healthy and available. All right, I got a question here from Mild Bill Davidson on Twitter that says, Ema, the super sub, the Revs certainly benefited from the Red Bulls' numerous international call-ups, and the goal was magic. Can they summon that kind of play against the Whitecaps next week? First of all, I think we should touch on a little bit on the goal, because it was a good goal from Ema Boateng, who hasn't gotten a ton of playing time recently. I had seen in the post game interviews that he had mentioned that Caleb Porter had a chat with him about him needing to play better. We saw that echoed sentiment echoed from Caleb Porter in his post game interview. So what do you think, Tom? What did you think of the goal? And do you think that that Ema needed to play better? And do you think that Caleb Porter's talking to him had any effect on his play this week?
Now, look, I like Boateng as a player off the bench. I think that's when he's made his biggest impact. You give him 20, 25 minutes, he's going to get at least one chance or put in at least one good cross in the limited time that he gets. And I think he fills that role really, really well. And off the bench, spark to the attack, even if you're up 1-0 and there's 20 minutes left, if you want to be a little more proactive in trying to get the second goal and try and kill the game off, he's a great guy in those situations too. So a tied game at home or a game where you're trying to, stretch a one goal lead to two, if Porter doesn't seem like the proactive type, but if you're chasing the game, he's a great guy to have, with the veteran player that he is and the skill set that he has to come in, and he can get up to speed in 3-4 minutes and give you a good 20, 25, 30 minutes whenever you need him to. I think that's a great role to keep him in. As far as Porter, it's like, come on, this stuff is a joke. I pulled him aside and told him he needed to be better. You got to be better for us. And then he goes out and scores the game winning goal. Okay, that's great. What have you been telling Veroni the whole season then? That would be my question. If you were able to pull Ema aside and just say, hey, Ema, we need you to be better, and he goes out and scores a goal, like, what do you think he's been telling Veroni for the whole season? So it's not – for anyone that thinks that coaching is that simple, I can assure you it is not that simple. The last team I coached, I had a couple players that I had a conversation about trying to, just kind of pick two or three things to focus on in our halftime talk. And they disagree. They said, no, we need to talk about all the things that we need to get better at. So they would sit there and rattle off like 6, 7, 8 things. And they convinced themselves that if they just talked about everything that needed to be better at halftime, that they would magically go out into the field in the second half and all these things would magically get better just because they talked about it. And I said to them, well, what do you think the other team does at halftime? They're also all sitting around saying, hey, we need to do this better. This stuff is not that simple. For every time I've never pulled a player aside and just say, hey, go out there and score a goal for us, huh? Give them a little wink in the eye and they go out there and score a goal. It's not that easy. But again, we have to listen to Porter for another week because he has to make sure that he gets credit for everything. Tell us that, he inspired Boateng to be doing something he's been doing for his whole career. Sure.
Right. Yep. Yeah. I think I agree with all that. Professional players probably don't need just a little, hey, go out there and do better. If it were that simple, it would be the Revs would be in first place. And furthermore, to that point, he has this talk supposedly with Boateng midweek, and then has no plans to start him apparently because you have a lineup that's depleted in terms of wingers, the position that Ema Boateng has played most recently, and you're putting Harks out there. Out of position instead of Ema. So I don't know that, you can say that, you had a chat with him and that really put him in his place and put him in the right headspace, but then, would rather play, a central midfielder ahead of him out wide. I don't know. It doesn't make sense to me. But. Yeah. All right. Let's see. Okay. So we have a question here from Big John. Is Barrero's form concerning to anyone else or just me? I think we touched on this a little bit. I don't know that I'm truly concerned yet, but you know, he's working back from injury. I think he's going to need some time, and he probably doesn't benefit from playing, you know, coming back from a year long injury and playing with a team that's struggled the way that they do. Do you have any more thoughts on that, or do you want to move on?
Yeah. I mean, just, not concerned, but you hope it gets better.
Right. Okay. Here's one from Aiden. Is my name on Twitter? I have a subjective question. Does Frioni have more value as a striker who makes runs behind or as a holdup striker? Because I feel like we're not using him correctly. So I touched on this early about his value as a holdup striker. I don't think that is where he is best suited. Is he better suited as a striker who makes runs in behind? Maybe, but he also hasn't proven that he's, you know, got enough finishing instinct that when he does get the ball in behind, that he's going to do much with it. And he was offside, caught offside a couple times in this game. So I don't know which is better, but I don't think hold up is what he excelled at last night.
No, it's someone else suggested last week. Oh, they should play him as a false nine, like a false nine. You want him to drop centrally into a tighter space and get on the ball more to do what with it? I mean, like, no, like we've talked about this so many times. He can't hold the ball up. He's not particularly good in the air. He can't run in behind. All he can do is hang out around the top of the penalty area when the team has already brought the ball into the attacking third for him, and he can make a short little 7-8 yard run and touch the ball twice and get a shot away. That is it. If you could give him 5 or 6 chances like that a game, he'd probably score 15 goals. But he gets one, and that's it. His skill set is extremely limited. There is really only one way in which he can score, and you know this team just isn't able to. And there's no point either, by the way. There's no point in constructing an entire team to extract the maximum amount of value out of someone who isn't really that good.
Right. Yep, and you have to think that if the Revs were not, you know, hadn't committed to him in such a you know, blatantly financial way, right, with, you know, his transfer fee and with his salary, you know, and the strictures of, you know, how MLS rosters are built, you know, you wouldn't think about trying to build around him or even play him if you didn't have other incentives to do so, just because, you know, strikers who have 2 goals in 15 games, that's, you know, that's certainly not DP level, but you know, if he weren't a DP, I think you'd be hard pressed to convince me that he would still be starting for this team.
Oh yeah.
Okay. We have a couple of questions here that are a little bit more positive. So Revs fan, this is a comment from Revs fan 1776 on Twitter. It says, "Is the moment where we come back, are we in the groove?" We have another question from Gabo that says, back-to-back wins for the Revs, are we all dreaming? And then one here from Brandon Popper on Twitter that says, with 8 games left until League's Cup break and the possibility of getting some new legs back, what do you think will be the Revs' record during this busy stretch? So some positivity here, which I think we could have expected after back-to-back wins. So let's kind of address that positivity generally. Do you think, you know, are the Revs back? And do you think that they'll have any success in this stretch leading up to League's Cup?
I mean, these 2 wins are like the other 2 wins before it, right? Narrow wins in which they just about hung on. And again, like, okay, New York is having a good season, but they had scored 27 goals going into last night. And the 2 players that produced 15 of those goals weren't there. So you're playing against a 12 goal team in 16 games without that's essentially those players that were available had scored 12 goals in 16 games. You know, and the win against Charlotte wasn't playing well at that time. The win against Chicago, I mean, Chicago is a, you know, they're a complete joke of an organization, and Nashville seemingly is incapable of scoring. So it's kind of the same story. It's happening back-to-back weeks. And if you didn't know who was missing from the Red Bulls last night, and you look at the standings this morning, you would say, oh, wow, they beat a team, you know, in the upper reaches of the playoff spots. But again, we have to be happy with what we've gotten. And yeah, I don't know. Hope that It's still hope. You're still just hoping that they're going to find a way to beat Vancouver next week. After that, two tough ones, Cincinnati away and Columbus at home. I can't imagine Porter's looking forward to that Columbus game at all.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's probably something to be said about, the momentum that you can maybe build on with back-to-back wins, even though I don't particularly think that these were well-constructed wins. We've talked a little bit about already how they were, the goals that we scored were low percentage chances. I think, if I'm remembering correctly, we were outpaced on expected goals in both games. Our four wins this season have been against, not the best teams. And of course the Red Bulls were without a bunch of their best players. I dug into this earlier in the season, right? Their expected goals total, about a month ago now, whenever we last played them, they were like 26th or 27th in terms of expected goals per 90, or non-penalty expected goals per 90. So even when they're at full strength, they don't create a ton of chances. They had just been outperforming their expected metrics, better than other teams. And there is, of course, something to be said for that in general. I'm not sitting here thinking that the Revs beating a team that doesn't create a ton when they have their best players, when they didn't have their best players in this game last night, necessarily means that there's anything sustainable or long-term about it. Looking at the schedule ahead, I don't think there's, I have similar confidence about those games as I had about the last couple of games. So I don't see this as a true return to more normal games for the Revs. I think we could continue to struggle with the schedule that's coming up here. Let's see. We've got one here. So this is from Mike from New Hampshire on Twitter. It's not a question, he says. He's just really torn. This means Caleb probably sticks around a little bit longer. I saw another question on here. I'll see if I can track it down. But I had the same thought, right? Back-to-back wins, while things to me didn't look like they were particularly sustainable, is that a bad thing? Does that help Caleb Porter, stick around for longer? Can we take that as a positive and maybe, with Caleb Porter as head coach, things will start to turn around. What do you think, Tom?
Yeah, I understand what Mike is saying, because to be honest, last week I was really like, I was preoccupied with just trying to figure out how bad would things have to get for this man to be gone. That's where my mindset was at. But the way to cope with this, the way to cope with basically this is the issue. People don't really like Caleb Porter because of how he conducts himself in the media and his player selection. People just flat out do not like him. However, if the team is winning, a lot of the annoying things that he does during the week when he talks, they're kind of funny now. It's just like, oh yeah, ha ha ha, yeah, okay, what ridiculous thing did he say, or how did he contradict himself? It's a little bit more enjoyable if the team is winning and the head coach of that team is coming out, every week and just saying his usual bunch of nonsense and taking credit for everything, and it's more tolerable if the team is winning. That's the first part. The second part is, as much as I and many, many other people wanted him to be fired, the reality is that we are fans of the New England Revolution. They do not do anything quickly. They don't do anything bold. So the reality is that as much as we might have tried to create a situation where it felt like there was pressure on his job, and some other like podcasts that cover MLS in general have voiced that as well in recent weeks, the reality is that he was probably always going to get this season no matter what. So basically, I think we were stuck with him no matter what. So if we're stuck with him, the team might as well play better. And it's still enjoyable to listen to all the nonsense that he says. And the third point is that a lot of the things that have been happening that have been allowing the team to win, he's taking credit for, but Mike from New Hampshire, I'm sure, has not been fooled by any of this, as has anyone else listening to this podcast, that this was not the plan. He wanted to get rid of Dave Romney. Now he can't drop him. He doesn't want to play kids, but he's been forced to play Esmir. And the biggest thing is, you know, he was talking the last time they played the Red Bulls, Steve Cangelosi was talking about how, oh yeah, we talked to Porter during the week and he's turning them into a positional team, away from being a transition team. Not so much. They've gone in the complete, they've basically gone back to playing how they played before. This isn't Porter ball. This isn't his way of doing things. And I think that the statistic that proves that the most, okay, there are six games this season in which the Revs have launched on goal kicks 75% of the time or more. So that basically means they just boot it down the field on a goal kick. They've done that six times, 75% or more. They have four wins in those six games. So when they don't build out of the back, when they don't do what Porter wants to do, they win. In the nine games in which they went long less than 75% of the time, 1 point. So Porter ball, 1 point. Playing how this team has played and been successful in the past, 12 points. So I think that is, sorry to be long-winded here, but this thing has been bothering me for the last couple of weeks. I really do not like the person that Porter presents himself to the public as. And we've heard from people around the league that this is how he is. He thinks he's the, I think it was Hercules Gomez said, the problem with Caleb Porter is he thinks he's the smartest person in every room he walks into. But the reality was he wasn't the smartest person that walked into that press conference 2 weeks ago when he attacked Sam for asking a question about Dave Romney. And turns out 2 weeks later, Dave Romney is undroppable. So I think that's what we just kind of have to live with. We're stuck with him, so they might as well win while he's here. And there's still some fun we can have with him along the way, because he talks a lot and he puts his foot in his mouth.
Right. Yep. Sorry, you know. No, that's totally fine. I think I agree, right? You know, my impression was that he was going to probably be here for the full season anyways. You know, that started to falter a little bit when, you know, we were at two wins and whatever it was, 9 or 10 loss. I can't remember exactly how bad it had been off the top of my head, but there was a point where it was just loss after loss after loss. And, you know, I started to think maybe he was potentially on the way out, but that was based on results, not based upon my understanding of how this team likes to operate. And it seems like this team is probably going to give him, you know, a little bit of extra leash in terms of in how long he sticks around. You know, we talk about fans not liking him because of the way he, you know, the team selection and the way he talks in press conferences. I think that's all fair. I think there's also, you know, we have some indications, you know, I take it with a grain of salt, right? Because these are questions to coaches and players in interviews about how the team chemistry is in the locker room. But, you know, they've all generally said that, you know, things are good behind the scenes. We have a question about that from Brandon Popper. I'm sorry. I have the wrong question up. Okay, sorry, from Josh Goulet. I was looking at the wrong section. From Josh Goulet on Twitter that says, what do you make of Boateng's celebration with him running almost straight to Porter for a hug? I'm not a Porter apologist, but it did make me wonder if the team actually does trust / like him. You know, do you think there's anything to that? Do you think that behind the scenes things are as good as the players have indicated they are? Or do you think that, you know, winning is the thing that maybe fixes some of the rifts?
Winning, from my experience, winning fixes everything. The players are not going to be honest about what they think while he's here. Like, they're not stupid. They're not going to come out and say anything against the guy that, you know, to use Porter's words, hires and fires half of them every week. Right? I mean, they're not going to come out and be totally honest. So, yeah, I mean, maybe, but it's because they're winning. It's that simple. Every team that I have ever coached, the players, myself, you know, my bosses, the parents, for sure, the parents, they're all happier when the team wins, right? It's that simple. When I was coaching teams and, you know, we'd win five, six games in a row, I could walk on water. I was the greatest coach in the world. Everything I did, you know, everything I did was incredible. That same team turns around and loses three games. We go, oh, this guy's an idiot. He's a clown. He's a fool. He doesn't know what, like, that's just how it is. Right. The best example of this is Brian Clough. Brian Clough, early on in his career, League Cup game goes to extra time. Okay. The halftime of extra time, Brian Clough sits on the bench, doesn't get up and doesn't even go over and talk to the players. They go on and they win that game. People come out and say, oh, Clough's brilliant. Right. Look at that. He knew that he didn't even need to talk to the players. And in that moment, they could see that he trusted him because he didn't even go over and talk to them. Okay. 12 years later, Brian Clough loses a cup final. And in halftime of extra time, he sat on the bench and didn't go over and talk to the players. And the narrative then was, oh, Cloughy's lost it. I mean, it's just, that's all it is. You win, everything's great. You lose, everything is crap.
Yep. I think that's probably it. You know, winning is a remedy that fixes a lot of ills. And of course, losing, on the other hand, is something that, you know, fans and players alike will focus on, even if things aren't as bad as they may seem. You know, I think the truth is usually somewhere in between those two things. So, you know, that Boateng makes a beeline for a hug with Porter, you know, I'm not reading too far into it. I'm also not reading too far into, you know, there was that whole controversy a few years ago with Kellen Rowe not doing a handshake with I think it was Brad Friedel at the time, or maybe no, sorry, it was Bruce Arena at the time, and you know, a lot was made about that tonight. I don't know. You can't really read into things like that happened during the games. I don't think there's much to glean from it. Okay, we have a couple more questions you know, maybe we can go through a little bit more rapid fire style, because we've kind of covered a lot of these topics. So one from Revs Wolves on Twitter that says, with Romney starting today, is Kessler now in Porter's doghouse? And one from Angela Costa that says, maybe Romney starting the last two games had something to do with it. So, you know, some love for Romney. I think that's been pretty consistent on the hashtag on Twitter that people have been pro Romney. But to the question about Kessler, do you think that, you know, we now see Kessler mostly on the bench as a guy who was pretty indispensable for Caleb Porter through the beginning of the season?
Yeah, I think so. Because, I mean, you know, Porter was willing, all of a sudden willing to answer questions about his team selection at the center back position last week. Again, winning, by the way, changes Porter's attitude pretty quick as well. All of a sudden you can ask this guy questions again and he's happy to answer them. But yeah, he said that, you know, it was really a matter of Kessler or Romney, because, you know, Arriaga is locked in as a starter until he gets his yellow card suspension. So I think Romney is a very, you know, he's a very smart, very steady player. Kessler at times is good, but Kessler does his best work inside the penalty area. Once he gets outside the penalty area, his decision making defensively and with the ball is questionable. So I think we're seeing what everyone thought Romney was capable of. So, yeah, I mean, there's no reason for it not to continue. And Kessler actually hasn't even moved into Caleb Porter's closer's role. You know, Porter thinks he's coaching the Red Sox now, where if you have a lead with 10 minutes, you've got to bring on, you know, you've got to bring your closer in. Kessler hasn't even been able to take the closer role off of Mensah yet.
Yep, that's right. And he did that last week. He brought Mensah in late to close out the game. He did the same this week. And then he also brought in Andrew Farrell. So if Henry Kessler is not able to get past, you know, both of those guys in terms of, you know, finishing out a game, you have to think that he's probably not super high on Caleb's starting depth chart at the moment. But that seems to change week to week. You know, he talks about consistency, but then he doesn't really put out consistent lineups. We have an email question. This one's from Owen Gio that says, I think this shows that Cam Polster can't handle a bit of pressure and Vrioni is still a lost cause. Who was worse tonight? So who do you think was worse between that trio of players?
Polster, Vrioni, and who?
It was Polster, Vrioni, and Kay.
God. I don't know. Vrioni. I mean, Kay played a forward pass at one point, and Polster managed to keep his studs down on that wild two-footed slide tackle and didn't get himself sent off. So, you know, that's a plus for Polster. Kay passed the ball successfully without, you know, not knowing that there's a player around him to take the ball off him. And Vrioni contributed really absolutely nothing. So Vrioni, the worst out of the three.
I think that tracks with what I saw as well. There were moments, you know, for all three of them that looked counterproductive. But I think even in the moments where you could say that Vrioni was the most productive, he wasn't providing much value. Okay, well, let's finish off here. I have a race car question, and I, as somebody who knows what a race car is, and that's about the extent of it, I'll leave this one to you, Tom. This one's from James Casella on Twitter that says, race car topic of the night with 24 hours of Le Mans happening at the end of the week. Who will stand top step when the race finishes? So I'll leave you to talk about that, and then we can close out after that.
Okay, I'll try and keep this quick. So the 24 Hours of Le Mans is a World Endurance Championship race that takes place in France each year, and it is a race that starts and goes for 24 hours straight. Whichever cars cover the most distance are the winners at the end of that race. Now, the interesting thing about the World Endurance Challenge is that there are three different classifications of cars on the track at the same time. So it's essentially three races at the same time, which makes it quite interesting. Certainly a lot more interesting than you might think a race that takes 24 hours could possibly be. So in the hypercar category, which is, for those of you that don't know, cars that look like spaceships, these are the front runners, and the winner of the hypercar class is the winner of the overall 24 Hours of Le Mans. I am going to go with the number 6 Porsche Penske Motorsport, the number 12 Hertz Team Jota, and the number 50 Ferrari AF Corsa to be on the podium for the hypercars. The Ferrari came third at Spa, the Hertz team won at Spa, and Porsche Penske is the overall leader going into this race. I personally will be rooting for Ferrari because I'll never own one, but they are Italian and I'm Italian-American, and that's probably as close as it's ever going to get for me. LMP2. Now, LMP2 are also prototypes that look like slightly smaller spaceships than the hypercars. And these are all the same car. So it's everyone gets basically the same car. So it's just a matter of the drivers and the team and strategy and, you know, so on and so forth. So I'm going with the number 22 United Auto Sports entry because they have my favorite driver, Nolan Siegel. The number 34 Inter Europol competition. They won 2023 Le Mans in the LMP2 category, and the number 37 Cool Racing. They won the ELMS 4 Hours of Barcelona. So United Autosports, Inter-Europa Competition, and Cool Racing on the podium for LMP2. And like I said, I will be pulling for Nolan Siegel in the number 22 United Autosports racing machine. And then last one up is the LMGT3 category. The LMGT3 category looks like cars that some of you may actually be able to attain at some point in your life. So these are based on production road cars. So if it's a Porsche 911, it's based off a Porsche 911 that some people that listen to this podcast might actually be able to afford. Certainly not Andy and myself. So for the LMGT3 category, I've gone with the number 92 Manthi Pure Racing. They lead the World Endurance Challenge through the first three rounds. The number 60, Iron Lynx. They are an Italian team that drives Lamborghini Huracans. They finished third at Spa. And the number 46, Team WRT. They finished fourth and second in the first two races. But I personally will be rooting for the Iron Dames, which is another Italian team made up all of female drivers, which is pretty cool. And they had a successful season last year. Haven't really got going this year. And last but not least, the Proton Competition team will be entering three Mustang GT3 cars. And it would be nice to see a Ford win at Le Mans again, because the French hate it when the Americans have success in anything that takes place in their country.
All right. Well, never let it be said that this podcast does not provide you bonus content or value for other sports. Also, Tom, I'll have you know that it's not that I can't afford a Ferrari, which I definitely can't. I just choose to drive around a Nissan hatchback because that's what I think looks the coolest. I assume there are no Nissan hatchbacks in this race, but anyways.
No, Nissan, Nissans, you can find those in touring cars, but yeah, that's about it.
All right. Well, if they need mine, well, actually they can't have mine, so I'm gonna keep using it. In any case, Tom, do you have any final thoughts? Anything that you've recently published for the Blazing Musket, or anything that's coming up that you want to plug? And where can people follow you on social media?
Yeah, my final thoughts are, you know, again, you know, two wins in a row, great. You know, we're seeing the team get results, kind of playing in the way that they've had success in the past. They're over-reliant on Carlos Hill, and they're playing on the counter. I'd like to see them, you know, direct some of those long balls out to the wings a little bit more. You maybe see Barrero play a little bit wider. You know, Nick Lima did a really nice job of getting himself an open space last night, and he was ignored repeatedly, as he typically is. So if they are going to go to this bypassing the midfield thing more often, which given the midfielders that we have, they certainly should. I'd like to see that go out to the flanks a little bit more in the next couple of weeks, and try and keep this thing going. You can find my work on the Blazing Musket. I'll be, the quarter two report that'll be coming out pretty soon. I think I might resurrect a piece I was going to write about Dave Romney and how great he is before he got dropped, seeing as he seems to be back now. And you can find me on Twitter at tpinzone343 if you want to talk about the Revs or if you want to talk about racing. So, yeah. So good, but it needs to get better.
Yep, I think that's a good way to close. For me, I just want to note that it's been a long time coming, but I finally got to host a podcast after the Revs won a game. I think that was partially because on last week's podcast, Sean talked about maybe swapping in and hosting just so that the Revs could win. So I think the Revs must have been listening, and he was able to successfully trick them. And so they went out and they actually played enough to do a win. So I'm glad that I got to be here. My my excitement is immeasurable, as you can probably tell from my voice. In terms of where you can follow my content, I now write for the Blazing Musket. That's a recent development. I have a piece up there that was published a few days ago. That was all about getting Giacomo Vrioni involved on the ball and the statistics that bear that out. So you can check that out over at the Blazing Musket. I will have more content on a semi-regular basis that will be, kind of stats heavy. So if you like that sort of stuff, give me a follow there. Or you can follow me on Twitter, Blue Sky and Threads at @AndyRevsNation. And of course, you can follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Revolution Recap. Please rate and review us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts, and be sure to check out our friends at the Blazing Musket. Thanks again for listening to Revolution Recap, presented by Bet Online, and we'll be back next week with another podcast.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.